It will be our privilege this morning to hear words of exhortation from our brother Ted Farah from Hamilton, Ontario. He has entitled his remarks, "The Importance of Belief in God as a Creator and the Importance of Belief in the Bible as a Divine Revelation." In connection with this, he has asked that we read from the 14th Psalm. "The fool has said in his heart, there is no God. They are corrupt, they have done abominable work, there is none that doeth good. The Lord looked down from heaven upon the children of men to see if there were any that did understand and seek God. They are all gone aside, they are altogether become filthy. There is none that doeth good, no, not one. Have all the workers of iniquity no knowledge, who eat up my people as they eat bread, and call not upon the Lord? There were they in great fear, for God is in the generation of the righteous. Ye have shamed the counsel of the poor, because the Lord is his refuge. Oh, that the salvation of Israel were come out of Zion, when the Lord bringeth back the captivity of his people. Jacob shall rejoice, and Israel shall be glad." We will now hear from our brother Farah.
Many books, pamphlets, and papers have been written about the decline of religion in the West. That is, in the countries which hitherto have called themselves Christian countries or part of Christendom. Why the decline of religion in the West has taken place, and why people have abandoned religion as a formal religious system and as a part of their old life, is not our purpose to discuss this morning. But I think we can say that it is true that belief in God and belief in the Bible and the practice of a formal so-called religious system has suffered a marked decline. Formerly, particularly Protestantism, practiced a religion which was based on the Bible. There was a belief that there was a God in heaven who was absolute, who did not change, and who set up a standard of excellence by which men could guide and practice their lives. Even the Protestants viewed the Bible as a divine revelation, a document given under inspiration of God, and not only given, but preserved also by inspiration and by the guidance of God, so that we have in our hands a divine record, a divine guidebook for life. The Ten Commandments were regarded as absolute, requiring no further discussion than the fact that God gave them and that they were to be obeyed as a standard of excellence. Take stealing, for instance. People didn't steal not because they thought they might be caught or something like that, but they didn't steal because there was a commandment, "Thou shalt not steal." And therefore they obeyed. And so the religious world of the West viewed the system as a total system. Now, what do we mean by a total system? Because we're going to be talking in a minute about some contrary total systems. By a total system, we mean a system that purports or affirms that it puts forward an analysis of the human condition, the human history, the meaning of life, and the final solution of the human problem. Now, this is what Christendom believed the Bible did. It believed that the Bible was a total system, that it explained the human condition, It explained not only the way we got into it, but it also explained the way out of it. And so it was a total analysis. It explained everything that man needed to know about life. Well, this concept suffered a great decline in the West and was probably culminated by the German philosopher Nietzsche, who said in the last century that God is dead. If there ever was one who was alive, he sure isn't alive now because he's dead. And that we don't need a revelation. And this is exactly what the Apostle Paul predicted would happen in the first chapter of the book of Romans. Speaking of people who were looking at the total system, he said, professing themselves to be wise, they became fools and changed the glory of the uncorruptible God into an image made like to corruptible men. And further on he says, who changed the truth of God into a lie and worshiped and served the creature more than the Creator. Now that's a very good definition of humanism, where the creature, that's humans, are elevated to a position of authority more than the Creator. Now when you get people who abandon belief in God, who reject the Bible as the authority by which to guide their lives, you have a vast vacuum prevailing. And a vacuum always has a tendency to be filled up with something. Now, if people dispel from their life God and the Bible, then they are wide open for having other things come in to fill up the void which has occurred. And of course, this, brothers and sisters, is exactly what happened. In 1848, the first fellow came along who designed a total system. He was going to tell humanity why we are here and what his system said about the finality of man. And his name was Karl Marx. In 1848, he issued the Communist Manifesto. And he propounded this thesis that man was originally innocent and free. But now he was enslaved by the wicked capitalists and he was a victim of the class system. So Marx proposed a solution, the communist solution to man's plight. He predicted a new day would dawn when the state would be abolished. The man would be free. There would be no more need for war, no more poverty, no more oppression. Utopia would have arrived. Well, the Bible already dealt with a man like Marx in the book of Jeremiah by saying, "It is not in man that walketh to direct his steps." I'll leave it to you whether or not the people, and there are billions in this earth who subscribe to the atheistic communistic theory, have reached their utopia. The next fellow who came along with a total system to explain everything was a man by the name of Charles Darwin. He published his book in 1859 called The Origin of Species, in which he propounded a theory that natural forces billions of years ago, acting on natural matter, produced the first form of life. And from this first simple, what he called simple form of life, came all living things that are now living or ever have lived on the face of the earth. And so he said there was no need for God because he believed in spontaneous generation. The things just got here by the forces of pure chance. So he had to find a mechanism by which this vast system would be driven up the evolutionary ladder. And he invented the mechanism of the survival of the fittest. And so he said that as the unfit were weeded out, and as the fit survived, man's intellect would go to higher and higher and higher points. And finally, he would arrive at utopia. That's why people are going to outer space, because they thought maybe the evolution out there worked faster than it did here, and maybe those people are twice as smart as we are, and they can tell us the solution of the problem that mankind finds itself in. In contrast to Darwin, who said there was no God and no need for God, the Bible said, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. The next fellow who came along was a man by the name of Sigmund Freud. It's hard to tell which one of these three musketeers did more damage to human society in the West, whether Marx did it, or Darwin did it, or Freud did it. I suspect that all three contributed to the mass decline that the West has suffered and is now suffering. Freud was the father of modern psychology, which in effect is just simply a system of humanism, where man is elevated to God and man can solve the problems which confront him. He developed a theory of human behavior called psychoanalysis. At first, people laughed at what he said. But because the human mind was receptive, they'd already abandoned God, and there already was a vacuum there. So a vacuum tends to be filled. And so this theory of Freud was a wonderful thing to fill the vacuum of people who were ignorant of God and of his divine revelation. And it wasn't long before, if you please, the theories of Sigmund Freud were called a science. Now, science comes from the Latin verb scio, which means I know. Not I think I know, or I presume I know, but I do know. So it wasn't long before the theories of Sigmund Freud took on the title of a social science. And now you go to a university and you get a calendar of the courses they offered, and you will find they offer courses in natural sciences like physics and chemistry and mathematics, which are exact, and they also offer courses in what they call the social sciences, as if they were exact also. Now, nothing, of course, could be farther from the truth. The so-called social sciences, far from being theories of I know, are theories only of I conjure up, or I'm theorizing about what may or may not be. And so these so-called social sciences, like psychology, social science itself, anthropology, and so forth, have all the professional trappings of real science, but without any of the substance. But the point is that they also bill themselves as presenting a total system. You send your kid to college and take a course in psychology. He comes out thinking he has the answers to the total condition of mankind. And so when somebody does something, he is supposed to be able to tell you why he does that, and why his mother whipped him when he was young, and all these fancy theories, which are a lot of baloney, in my opinion. And he is supposed to be able to prescribe the remedies and the reasons for the total system that mankind finds himself in. Well, this great man, Sigmund Freud, who did so much to ruin the West, at the end of his life, wrote a book called Beyond the Pleasure Principle. And strangely enough, this great man, who is revered and feared by millions of college students, reverted to Greek mythology, if you please, to explain the system. He said there were really two great gods, the god of pleasure and the god of death. And the god of death was going to be triumphant. And so, at the end of his life, when he looked over the whole thing, the best Freud could come up with was the death was peace and the end. Now, this is the theory, ladies and gentlemen, that thousands and millions of students are taking and calling it a science. Think of the evil work that this man did with his teaching. We have on our hands a depraved society, utterly depraved. We have a society that makes Sodom and Gomorrah look like a garden party. At least Sodom and Gomorrah didn't have the stuff coming into their living rooms. But now we have a situation prevailing where the mentor of America is television. And most of that garbage which comes over is a reflection in some way or other of one of these three men, Marx, Darwin, or Freud, or all three put together. The whole educational system is a reflection of the teachings of these three men. Your daughter, age 17, if she takes some of these so-called social sciences, never mind in college, but even in high school, will be given books that the human mind should not read. They're totally depraved. And this is billed as great literature. What it really is downright stinking garbage. And yet your kids and mine are asked to read this stuff and to educate themselves in its teachings. Well, time has gone on. These men flourished either last century or at the beginning of this century. But the vacuum is still there because the vacuum still hasn't been filled with the teachings of God in the Bible. The vacuum is still there. And let me tell you something. The less you know about the Bible, I'm talking to the younger people now, the less you know about the Bible, and the less you know about God, the more open you are to all the kooky theories that are coming along. In other words, if you have a shallow idea about God and the Bible, then you're an open pigeon to have all this other stuff poured into your mind, and you are ill-equipped to shuck it off or to deal with it. Well, time goes on, as we said. Now what do we find? We find that people are a little bit, they see that communism isn't working very well. They see that the theories of Freud haven't improved the society. If there's any test whereby a theory should be proven to be right or wrong, it should be whether it works. And certainly the theories of Freud haven't worked, and the theories of Darwin have been proven and shown to be ill-founded as well and false. So now what do we find? We actually find people now reverting to things that were in vogue thousands of years ago. And one of the principal things that people are filling this vacuum with, if you please, is astrology. Now, can you imagine anything worse than for people who are supposed to know something? We're told that this system that is now educating the people has made our people the smartest that ever were since the beginning of time. We're supposed to be really smart. And what do we find? You go into a bookstore and you have racks and racks and racks of books on astrology and the occult. What is astrology? Astrology, according to the encyclopedia, is the art or science which claims to forecast events on Earth by observation of the fixed stars and of the sun, moon, and planets. In other words, it too bills itself as a total system. In other words, the fixation of the heavenly bodies is supposed to totally solve man's plight. Now, don't ever think it's just some fringe idea that you can sort of have over here and the real thing is in the center. Astrology is also a total system of the explanation of man's finality. It originated in Mesopotamia, perhaps in the 3rd millennium B.C., but attained its full development only much later within the orbit of Greek civilization. Now, the Greeks, of course, believed in mythology, in the gods. And they believed that the heavenly bodies were people. The sun was a person, the moon was a person, the stars were persons. not only persons, but that they were powerful gods. They married, they got divorced, they had children, and so forth. So all these heavenly bodies were actually people. Now this is a system that is now being, if you please, taught in colleges as a science. Now the astronomers of Greece not only revealed the celestial bodies as wheeling eternally in their circular orbit, according to the laws of Greek spherical geometry. In other words, there is a system of astronomy, which is the measurement of the heavenly bodies, which is a different thing from astrology. They also showed them palpitating with life and passions of the familiar gods. In other words, the movements of these heavenly bodies up there were the gods moving around in the heavens. The sun, moon, and planets, being living beings, had their preferred situations or abodes among the stars. These are referred to as houses. The influence of the planets is therefore further modified by these houses. To these houses, however determined, were assigned the several departments of human life. The planets of the various houses giving information about the matters pertaining to their sphere of influence, such as wealth, dignities, marriage, children, friendship, enmities, and death. In other words, these heavenly bodies were supposed to teach the people a total system of life. Now, I don't know, I don't suppose anybody in this room is fooling around with astrology. But it would be quite surprising to me if such was the case. People make jokes about it. But the fact of the matter is, brothers and sisters, that this is no thing to play with. This whole system, which is an attempt to explain man's plight, is of pagan origin, is based on Greek mythology, and only God can foretell the future. The future cannot be told by Jean Dixon sitting out on her back porch looking at the stars. My exhortation is to you, don't fool around with this stuff. It was utterly condemned in the Old Testament, as you know. These people who practice it were to be stoned. If you read these books or these newspaper columns long enough, you will come across something which seems to fit your case because it's written so enigmatically that it's going to fit something you do sometime, somewhere. And the day you read that thing that seems to fit your case, you know, you're going to say, you know, I think there's something to it. And the first thing you know, you're going to start believing that garbage. So don't fool around reading astrology, either books or newspaper columns, or listening to it on the radio or television. And whatever you do, for goodness sake, don't wear one of these crazy things around your neck, because you're just advertising to everybody from Dan to Beersheba that you're a pagan. Now, the next thing that filled the void lately was Eastern religions. People go to college and they take courses called comparative religion. And they compare Christianity with Buddhism, with Zoroastrianism, with Mohammedism, with Shintoism, with all kinds of isms, as if they were all sort of in the same category, and maybe you could find pretty good things in all of them. And in fact, some people decide that what they will do is put all these isms together and come up with their own ism, which is really wonderful. And so you have people reading all kinds of, going to a bookstore, don't take my word for it, you'll see a whole rack of books on these Eastern religions. They also put themselves forward as purporting to solve the total system, the total picture of man. And so you have stuff like transcendental meditation, Silva mind control. All these things are based on the immortality of the soul, that man is really immortal and that he's going to go on to further Nirva and all these Nirvana and all these wonderful things later on. And all of them are false. So you see, when a man abandons belief in God and in the Bible as a divine revelation, he is an open cistern, you might say, for all these crazy ideas to go into. And what's the latest? The latest is UFOs. People see UFOs. Why do they see them? Because they hope that somebody from elsewhere will solve man's plight, will tell him what it's all about, tell him why man is here, where he's going, and what the final thing of this world is. They hope that these little fellows that get out of these UFOs will come and tell us things, because they've evolved in Mars or somewhere, and they're far smarter than we are, so they can solve the human situation. That's why people see UFOs, which are non-existent, not because they're there, but because they are hoping that from elsewhere, from somewhere, will come the solution to man's position. Now, in contrast to that, we have something that we call the truth. Have you ever had this experience? You're talking to somebody, and you happen to mention that something about the truth, that so-and-so is in the truth, or he isn't in the truth, or he heard about the truth or something, and the person says, "Hey, wait a minute. Where do you get that business about the truth? I object to that. I don't agree that you should call what you believe the truth." You ever had that happen? Sure you have. You've had that happen, where they say, "I hope you Christadelphians don't believe you're the only ones that are going to be saved," you know, with blood in their eyes. Come up to you and say that, you know. Well, when anybody comes up and says that to me, I always think, now, what is the reason? What's going on back in the head when they come up with that? There's more to it than just that. There's got to be something more to it. Well, it just so happens, brothers and sisters and young people, that what we have happens to be the truth. When Pilate said, "What is truth?" Truth is resident in this divine revelation. It's a handbook for man's total solution. That's what it is. It talks about man's origin, man while he's here, and man's destiny. And not only that, the destiny of this planet. Now, when we come to look at what the Christadelphians teach, I want you, as we go through a short list here, to think if there's anybody else who teaches the truth that we teach. People have parts of it, it's true, but can you think of another group who teach God as the supreme being, the architect and the creator of this universe, and that he has jurisdiction over all men? Don't ever get the idea that because you are not baptized, God has no jurisdiction over you. Or because you are not baptized, you are under no obligation to God, that you can thumb your nose at God with impunity and with immunity and come away scot-free. That is the most pernicious doctrine that can be taught. God has jurisdiction over all men everywhere. And no man can stand up and say, "God has no claim on me." You mean to say that mortal man is in the position to decide for himself whether the Almighty has jurisdiction over him? What kind of teaching is this? God has many times in the past, throughout the pages of this book and many other times, demonstrated that he very much has jurisdiction over men of all stripes. Secondly, we Christadelphians teach that this book, which we have in our hands, consisting of the Old and New Testament, is a unit. In other words, it's one revelation. And we study and we work at unifying the divine message. Now, there's a rather unique thing, too, that we do that not many other people do. Not with the precision and with the depth and with the understanding that we do, because we start off in the first page of the book with the origin of man and how he got into this disposition, how he got into this mess. And then we read along how man can get out of this mess. In other words, we say this is a total system which completely solves man's problems and tells man how he is in the position he is in. Thirdly, we believe that and teach that God has a purpose with this earth and with mankind upon it. We believe that history is going somewhere. That history is not a knotless thread going along in a haphazard direction, but there's a finality, a goal to the human system. That a purpose is being worked out here below through the nation of Israel, both natural and spiritual. Now, how many people believe that you know? How many people do you know who have the correct view of human nature? In my view, the Christadelphians are unique in this view of human nature, because we believe that we are, first of all, that we're mortal, that this flesh of ours is poor stuff. It's prone to sin. It's under the dominion of sin, under the power of sin. And that we, by birth, are under the dominion of death. That by nature we have no hope. We're without God in the world. Now that's the view we have of human nature. How many people do you know that have that view of human nature that we teach? And so when we are talking what people talk about, the fundamentals of the truth, these are fundamental things, and they're getting rarer every day. Don't ever get tired of a brother talking about Christadelphian fundamentals, because if we quit talking about them, it's only just no time before that vacuum that I was talking about will be filled with all these other things that people are talking about in schools and colleges and over the television and radio every day of the week. How many people do you know that have the correct view of the Bible, devil, and Satan? In this day, when you have movies of exorcism and all this bunk, people are all shook up about these things. But how many people do you know who really understand what the Bible view of the devil and Satan and Diabolos really is? Again, how many people do you know who have the correct view of Jesus Christ himself? The humanity of Jesus. That he too was born under the dominion of death and was a beneficiary of his own sacrifice. Very, very rare, if not unique, is the Christadelphian view of this. And in fact, there are forces at work that want to undermine even that view that we have historically held. How many are there who have a correct understanding of the temptation of Jesus in the wilderness when he was tempted on three occasions? How many have a correct view of his triumph over sin as he went to the cross, in which Brother DiLiberto is talking about this week in more detail? How many believe in the literal resurrection of the body of Jesus, that he actually came out of that grave possessing immortal life and is alive forevermore at the right hand of God? And how many believe in his literal return to this earth? We could go on when we talk about the truth. How many believe in the resurrection of the dead as the hope of mankind? Almost everybody, including all these Eastern religions and all this stuff you hear about, are all based on the immortality of the soul. They have an incorrect view of the plight of man and the nature of man. How many really understand that man's hope is in the resurrection from the dead? Not very many. How many believe in divine judgment, both in this life and in the life which is to come? Very few. How many believe that the Bible presents a total system, a complete solution to man's predicament? How many read this book to find out the solution both for their own predicament and the predicament of the world. Very few. Bible reading, alas, is just about a thing that has perished from the earth, even among our own people. And again, let me emphasize, the less you know about the Bible, the more open you're going to be to theories about UFOs, about transcendental meditation, about Zen Buddhism, about Darwinism, and every other ism. And the more you know about the Bible and the fact that it is a divine revelation, the less influence you're going to have by these nutty ideas which are on every hand. How many really believe in the literal return of Christ to this earth? They believe in the return of Christ to some sort of a rapture or something like that. But how many believe that his feet will actually stand on the Mount of Olives, which you can take a plane and go and see, that his feet will stand on this earth? How many believe that literally? Very few. How many believe that on his return a kingdom will be established that will cleanse the earth of pollution and crime and all the other ills, and poverty and unemployment and all the other ills and pain and suffering which beset mankind? How many believe that the inheritance of the saints are the things promised under the Abrahamic covenant? Abrahamic covenant? They don't know what it even is. Never mind what its import is. I keep talking about the necessity of knowing more about the Bible, young people. I was talking to a brother the other day. This brother is a very intelligent brother, very good brother, and very well read in the scriptures. And they asked him to teach a young people's class at one of the Bible schools. I don't want to say which one because it doesn't matter. And he was prepared to teach some, these are students in their late teens, maybe 18, 19, perhaps 20, something like that. He had fixed, as you say in Arkansas, to teach a class on the life of Jesus, where he was going to go into some depth about the real purpose of Jesus' life and so forth. So he started off. It wasn't very much, very long he got into it before he found that the level of understanding of his students was so abysmally bad that he had to abandon his lessons and get down to just teaching simple Bible stories and parables for the balance of the week. Only one person had ever heard of the Transfiguration. Now, this is a bad situation. Now, you see, when you get a student, 17, 18, and 19, has never even heard of the Transfiguration, never mind many other things, think what a vacuum his mind is, or her mind, for the introduction of all this stuff that is going on in the world. You send your kid to college, never heard of the Transfiguration, never heard of 10,000 other things about the Bible, and he takes these courses engineered by silver tongue professors for 4 years, do you think he's going to come out of there some super-duper Bible student? Because if you do, I have news for you. We live in a very peculiar world, brothers and sisters, and not one to toy around with. How many believe that at the return of Christ, the nations will be subdued and people will be demanded to live and learn and obey the commandments of the Lord Jesus Christ, who will be King of Kings and Lord of Lords? And if they don't, they will be destroyed. How many believe that? Why, people now, the Jesus people, have Jesus pictured as some person who is so full of peace and love and serenity and all that, that that if a mosquito appeared on his arm, he wouldn't swat it. He might hurt the poor little thing. This is the picture they have of Jesus, not a man descending from heaven, clothed with the power of God, who is Lord of lords and King of kings, and who will execute judgment in the earth. And lastly, how many believe that the divine solution to man's plight is that the whole earth shall be filled with the glory of God as the waters cover the sea? How many believe that there is in existence in this earth a great false religious system called the Roman Catholic system, calling itself Christianity, calling itself the name of Christ, the head of it sitting in the temple of God saying that he is God, but it really is a false, great false system? How many believe that the other churches are the daughters of this system, basing their teaching on the doctrine of the immortality of the soul and the trinityship of the Lord Jesus Christ? How many believe that this great system is the Antichrist, who has deceived the people for hundreds and hundreds of years over the term and is still deceiving them? Well, the Christadelphians are a group of people who believe that and who teach it. And so when you look at the unique teaching that the Christadelphians have, you can see that we have every right and privilege to call what we teach from the pages of this book the truth. It's a deposit of truth which fortunately was left to us by our forebears who have gone before. Not many of us have dug it out of our own selves. Now, I don't want to close either without making a mention or two of the present day events. You know, I want to give you your money's worth. I only have one crack at you, and this is it, so I have to make the best use of my time. But I do want to have everybody turn to the book of Zechariah for a minute, because there's no question in my mind, we are living in the very last days before the return. By the way, this brother was telling me, the one who found out that they never even heard of the Transfiguration, that when he asked them to turn up the book of Deuteronomy, they had to look in the index. Very bad situation we have on our hands. One that is very worrying to me, at least. Anyway, in the 12th chapter of Zechariah, we have a statement made here in verse 2 and 3, which is the most remarkable thing that is happening in this generation. Behold, I will make Jerusalem a cup of trembling unto all the people round about, when they shall be in the siege, both against Judah and against Jerusalem. And in that day will I make Jerusalem a burdensome stone for all people. All that burden themselves with it shall be cut in pieces, though all the people of the earth be gathered together against it. Now, we are living, brothers and sisters, in a time when this prophecy is on the brink of fulfillment. Only God could contrive the most amazing situation that you could possibly think of as it confronts the world today. Now, what is the amazing situation? We have a situation prevail where the whole world is hanging by a thread. And that thread is oil, or energy. We have a situation prevail where 96% of European oil is imported from the Middle East, and 50% of American oil is imported from the Middle East. If that oil is ever cut off, you know the chaos that will prevail here? Why, last winter we had the temperature drop a few degrees and 2 million people were out of work, and the worst panic and everything prevailed you ever saw in your life. Factories shut down and everything because there was an energy shortage. Gas didn't heat the buildings and so forth. Can you imagine what will happen in this country and I'm not saying if, I'm saying when the oil is cut off, when 50% of the energy generated by oil in this country is suddenly terminated, it's almost unbelievable to predict the chaos, the burning, the looting, the shooting, the violence that will occur when this happens. Now, what's this got to do with Jerusalem? Well, as I said, it's the most amazing thing how that this world, which is run by what we call an oil culture, has Jerusalem as its center. Now, how is that? That takes place because the Arabs have the oil. And the Arabs have demanded the return of the city of Jerusalem. And the Jews, while they will negotiate the Golan Heights, the Gaza Strip, the Sinai Peninsula, and many other things, they have steadfastly refused to negotiate the city of Jerusalem. Everybody thought at the last election a softer prime minister would win easily. Turned out that Mr. Begin, who is a hard-nosed man and who has publicly said he will never give back the city of Jerusalem, is now the prime minister, and he's the one that's doing the negotiating. So we have a situation prevail where the city of Jerusalem, not Paris, not New York, not Houston, not Toronto, but Jerusalem, is a burdensome stone to all nations. And it's on that stone that the next great crisis in human affairs is going to take place. And it probably will take place this year, because this Geneva conference is going to be convened in the early fall, and Jerusalem is not negotiable. So where do we go? We have an immovable force, an irresistible force meeting an immovable object. And the Jews, the nation of Israel, are going to be blamed for the oil crisis. Think of this, a nation that hasn't got a drop of oil are going to be blamed for the oil crisis. And all people are going to forsake her and leave her, and she will stand alone. And then will come the crunch, the crisis, that we have been looking for 125 years. Now, only the Most High God, could contrive world events to rule in the kingdoms of men that would bring about an amazing situation of this kind. Now, this subject deserves a whole lecture, but I didn't want to sit down when we're talking about the truth. We understand that Jerusalem is the key to world politics. Other people don't understand that. They think that Carter is the key, or Brezhnev, or somebody. But Jerusalem is the key to world politics, and it will be the stone on which all nations of the earth will stumble, and which will bring about the final event, which will bring the coming of Christ to this earth and the solution of man's problems. So when we say, brothers and sisters, that we have the truth, we are not talking through our hat. We are talking that we really do have in our hands a complete, total solution to man's disposition, to the history of the world, the events that are coming on the world, and the solution to those events. And also, of course, the solution to our own personal salvation. And in conclusion, I can't do better, I think, than read the closing sentiment that Solomon set down in the book of Ecclesiastes, where he said, "Let us hear the conclusion of the whole matter. Fear God and keep His commandments, for this is the whole duty of man."